to be American.
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
The news can be overwhelming these days. Wars, misinformation, fights for democracy, both at home and abroad. Too often, it seems, we spin our wheels playing whack-a-mole at the latest transgression, only to have to shift gears at a moment's notice. It can be exhausting. Politics has become so polarized that we avoid talking to neighbors about anything controversial. So, many people do what is only natural. They try to tune it out. We turn inward. Our daily lives are busy enough as it is. We can't really change what's happening in Washington, so why bother? Plus, life seems to go on fairly normally for many of us, regardless of the chaos that might be infecting Washington, D.C. Also, it's distressing. Studies show that politics can create significant anxiety, causing mental health issues. But, as our guest will explain, throwing in the towel in this moment of anti-democracy is exactly the wrong approach. Instead, we need to engage even more. Our guest today is Joyce Vance, the author of Giving Up is Unforgivable, a manual for keeping our democracy. The title says it all. The book explains that democracy is the collective responsibility of all concerned Americans, and that there is a role in the preservation of our democracy for each and every one of us. Joyce is a New York Times bestselling author, former United States attorney, and current professor at the University of Alabama School of Law. She's also a legal analyst for MS Now, formerly known as MSNBC, writes the Civil Discourse newsletter on Substack, and co-hosts two podcasts, Sisters in Law and The Insider. Joyce, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much for having me. It's nice to be with you.
So you began writing this book, Giving Up is Unforgivable, soon after the 2024 election. What about that election caused you to write a book? And the title, I think, is really poignant. So tell us about the impetus for the book and its title.
So I started actually by writing a column for my Substack newsletter, Civil Discourse, shortly after the election, which in essence was a 1,000-word version of the book. My concern after the election was I was having so many conversations with people who said, I did everything that I could during this election, and we lost, and I am out of gas. I'm just going to walk away. There's nothing else that I can do. And I thought, how uniquely dangerous to have a second Trump presidency with no public opposition, without, you know, what we frequently call sunlight, the best disinfectant. Because it was clear from the outset, anybody who had read Project 2025, and I had in advance of the election, that we were in for a rougher ride than during the first Trump administration, where democracy and democratic principles were concerned. And I thought it was important to rally people to the viewpoint that we each bore responsibility for preserving democracy. So I just wrote this little 1,000-word column and got a call out of the blue from a publisher saying, hey, would you turn this into a book? And because I didn't know any better at the time, I said yes.
Your book opens with the folktale of a frog in a pot, saying that we are now like the frog. So tell us kind of that story and why it's relevant today.
Right. You know, it's the notion that if you put frogs in a pot with cool water and very slowly bring it to a boil, by the time they realize it's boiling, they're cooked, right? They can't get out. And so what I encourage people to do is to be careful observers of what's going on. I'm writing this back in January, February, even early March of last year, as the Trump administration is just gearing up. And my concern is that we're going to be the frogs, that we had jumped out of that pot in 2020 when Trump was defeated at the polls, but now we've climbed back in. And you know, I think the great takeaway is, and I'm surprised by how well the book has held up, frankly, a year out. As I was writing it, I was hearing from a lot of people just in conversation, well, you're a drama queen. Things aren't really that bad. You know, we've got guardrails in place. It'll all be okay. And that actually was the frog mentality at work. So it just urged me on to keep writing. But now we have jumped out of the pot. In Portland, literally, protesters jumped out of the pot, put frog costumes on, and went out and protested against ICE, which I think is a tremendously powerful use of the metaphor. But we all have to make that personal choice. Are we going to sit back and tolerate what's happening? Maybe we think we have the resources to sit it out and it won't affect us. Or are we going to do whatever it takes to get out of the pot while there's still time and fight for democracy?
One of the problems I think that many people find is that young people don't seem to be engaged in democracy as much. There's this feeling that young people are really apathetic, that we have such a non-voter problem, something that my current research is looking into. I don't think it's apathy. I think it's something beyond apathy, that apathy is the symptom, not the cause. But you do identify how young voters are maybe not as invested in democracy as prior generations. Why do you think that is?
So, you know, if you're 22, 23, 24, you may have no recollection of living in a functional democracy. Your whole memory may be the first Trump administration. And so the enthusiasm, you know, just the optimism of the Obama era, I don't want to pretend that there was stability under Bush or under Clinton or under Carter or under Reagan, but at least we had people who crossed the aisle and got things done. I think that really the origin story for our present moment is back in those administrations. But at least if you grew up then, you understood that it was possible to move forward, that a bipartisan Congress could renew the Voting Rights Act every time it had to be reauthorized. But for kids like my youngest son, who's a recent college graduate, all that they remember is a democracy that looks an awful lot like an autocracy.
And how do we change that mentality? How do we encourage people, young people in particular, to embrace the ideals of democracy so they don't just turn inward and say, you know, I can't do anything, and that's for the people in D.C. to figure out?
So I don't want to pretend that it's easy. I think a big part of it is taking on a family obligation for civics education, and sort of taking the view that civics education starts at home, in our communities, with our friends and our families, and talking really candidly with our kids about these issues. You know, I write in the book about my youngest kid who got really mad at me when I said, well, Ollie, what would it take for you to read a book about democracy, to care about democracy? And this is a smart, well-educated, very liberal kid who has voted Democratic in every election since he's been able to vote. And he said, you know, Mom, I remember when the Occupy protests were going on, and nothing has changed. The billionaires still run things. Don't ask me to fix something. I'm just a college kid. How am I supposed to have the resources to confront billionaires? And for them, I think in many ways, it's a pragmatic assessment of where they are. It's not that they've given up. It's that they feel like they never had a fair start. And so I think we have to really have candid conversations with folks like that. You know, the most important thing that we can do is convince them that if they sit it out, it's their lives, right? And they will not live in a functional democracy. Their best shot is to get engaged in electoral politics, to educate themselves about candidates, to vote, and to realize that as a voting bloc, they have considerable power. So I'll use my home state as an example. The governor's race in Alabama this year will feature a Republican, Tommy Tuberville, the former Auburn football coach, who's currently our senator, and Doug Jones, a former U.S. attorney, former senator, who will be the Democratic nominee. And that'll be a very stark choice for young people between two very different policy perspectives. And they do have this ability to influence the future by voting. You know, people love to say that all politics is local. It's very true, and especially true for 18 to 30-year-olds. Your mayor, your state elected representative, your governor, those folks have a lot of influence over your life. Big issues, right? Like whether marijuana is legal or not, which is an issue that folks in that age range care about deeply. Employment, your ability to afford a home, influenced by state elected officials as well as federal ones. And so I think it's tough to make the case. sometimes to these folks to believe that they do have some power. But that's my job. You know, as part of the generation that screwed this stuff up, I think we have to help them realize that we're here to help them fix it.
And it's also cultural, right? I mean, you know, we can tell them to vote, but young people aren't necessarily going to just do what we say. So there's something about the culture. You mentioned the civic education. I think institutions are important as part of this. So how do we create that culture of participation beyond just telling young people, hey, you're affected by this, so you should probably participate?
It's what we do much more than what we say. So I grew up in a family where my mom and my granddad took us with them to vote, and it was sort of a big deal. And my husband, who's also from a very political family, my father-in-law was the head of the Alabama Democratic Party. Back when Alabama was an all-Democratic state, then he became a judge and walked away from politics. But my husband was sort of raised with those deep political roots. We've got four kids. Election Day was a family event. I think that might be in some years, especially when the kids were in high school. The only times when I could get a picture of all six of us together was, you know, getting pancakes on Election Day. And, you know, it's a little bit unfair, right? Because I was raised in that family culture and not everybody is. But what we can do is we can bridge that gap. We can reach out to other people and help them feel the excitement around Election Day. We can take people to hear speakers. For so many of us, we don't feel like we have access to politicians or to the political process, especially if you live in a state where your senator or representative just ducks and dodges public meetings, right? But I think that there's a fine line between being disappointed in the process and not knowing what your entry point is and refusing to take advantage of opportunities. And so what we can do is continue to offer those opportunities. I'll tell you, I had this ray of hope moment. I was speaking up in a small town at a small private college up in Maine, and I wasn't really speaking at the college. I was just speaking in that community about the book. I was stunned by the number of young people from the college who turned out, who were really interested and really eager to learn and figure out their role. I think sometimes what people just need is an invitation or someone who will help them get started.
We're speaking with Joyce Vance, who is a legal analyst, commentator, and the author of the book, Giving Up is Unforgivable. Joyce, this show is called Democracy Optimist, and I want to read a sentence from your book that I think is really poignant because, you know, so many people right now, I think, believe that democracy is totally messed up and there's nothing good going on. And you write, quote, "It's easy to see where our democracy is weak, but more difficult to see where we are strong." So where are we strong in this current moment?
You know, we have so much strength in democracy, and we all know, right? It's always easy to focus on the bad stuff. That, for one thing, is what the media tends to put in front of us. That's what we get served for breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day, is the clickbaity bad stuff. Where are we strong? We are strong institutionally. You know, our institutions in many ways are as strong as the people who populate them. So the easiest example for me is the Justice Department. When you have an attorney general with integrity who has vision for justice and public service, then the Justice Department looks that way. And when you have an attorney general who has decided that her job is to execute the president's revenge agenda, then the Justice Department looks very differently. I don't want to pretend that it will be easy to fix the institutional damage that's been done, but it is clearly something that can happen. There are a lot of career professionals across the country who are actively thinking about how to restore cabinet-level agencies like the Justice Department and others with an infusion of old experience and new young people who are eager to do the job and serve country and community. And so I think what we need to understand is voting again is essential, right? Voting is the right that unlocks all of the other rights. Returning stable pro-democracy leadership, it doesn't matter what party it's from. We just need people that believe that country matters more than party and that serving the American people matters more than politics and power. But if we can put the right people in institutions, then they can go back to doing their job, which is to work for all of us. You know, the founding fathers were very clear about where power was supposed to be in our democracy. And it was with us, the people, the folks that we elect to represent us, to go to Washington. They have power only because we've given it to them. We live in this era of a powerful unitary executive, a supine Congress, and a Supreme Court that has weighed in repeatedly on the side of the president when it comes to these questions of the expansion of executive power. And that sort of an environment suggests that it's very important to have people in the Senate and in the House who believe that their job is to act as a check and balance on executive power so that there's a balance between the three branches. And that's what really needs to be restored, is that institutional balance.
You just mentioned country over party, and it made me think that a lot of our conversation has essentially been anti-Trump, and it might seem to listeners that this is just a partisan push, that, you know, the conversation is about, you know, people who don't like the current president and want to do everything they can to stop the current president. What's your response to that idea that, you know, this is just partisanship and the Democrats are on the losing side of it, and so they're angry?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a really hard part in these conversations, right? Because in some ways, much of this is anti-Trump. I don't view that as being political, though. I'm just not a knee-jerk, pull the lever kind of a voter. I really like to know who I'm electing. And my policy positions don't really fit neatly into a box in many regards. And so what I have come to understand is that it's actually Donald Trump who is unique, right? Someone who is uniquely willing to benefit from the prerogatives of the presidency, someone who does not believe in the rule of law. That's not politics. That's democracy stuff. And so we have to evolve from being susceptible to this argument that any opposition to Trump is, you hate Trump, you have Trump derangement syndrome. And the response to that, I think, is, well, much of my criticism is of this president. You know, the unitary executive theory, that's one thing. I might disagree with that and want to have a conversation with my more conservative colleagues about its legal merit. But what I think we should all be able to agree is that no president should be using that to say that no matter what he does, he has no possible criminal liability. Say you take a bribe to deliver a pardon, that should be a criminal act. I think that we can all get there pretty easily. Presidents shouldn't be able to use the power of the presidency to, and I'm just making this stuff up, right? I'm just giving examples of stuff that no one has proven exists. But, you know, you shouldn't be able to use the power of the presidency to force foreign countries to invest in your businesses. Just take whatever of the horrible examples that you want. I think that we are in a unique moment in this country's history where if we just say it's political both sides-ism, then we're missing the point, which is that it isn't. And we have a uniquely dangerous man in the White House.
And the framers of the Constitution anticipated and were concerned about something like this, right?
They absolutely were, right? The Constitution gets written in reaction to the rule of a king. And the founding fathers want to make sure that we won't be subjected to the whims of a future ruler. So that's why we have the familiar structure of government. Three branches of government, no over-consolidation of power in the hands of one branch, checks and balances when government functions. And that really goes to the core of my objection, frankly, to the unitary executive theory. But what we're living with now is not even the wildest dreams, right, of proponents of the unitary executive theory back in the post-Watergate era. We now live in a world where, you know, if we want to be kind, we have a president who wants to be a monarch. If we want to be fair-minded and look at what's actually going on, I think that becomes closer to an autocrat or a dictator. That's a view for this country that the founding fathers rejected out of hand. And the real problem is that Congress has refused to stand up and insist on the founding fathers' intent.
The unitary executive theory, this is this idea that essentially all power can get consolidated in the presidency. You mention in the book the importance of the rule of law to combat anti-democracy tendencies. Tell us more about how the rule of law should be upheld.
You know, at its most basic, the rule of law says we are a country of laws, not of men, meaning that our rights and responsibilities are set forth in a set of laws that everyone has access to. We all know how the system works. We all know what the consequences of certain kinds of conduct are, both in civil disputes and in criminal settings. And so that's actually sort of the vehicle that lets us go, right? You can rent an apartment and give your landlord money because you know that they have to let you stay in the property that you've paid for. And if they try to cheat, that the courts will enforce your rights. I mean, that's maybe a very basic example. It's why foreign investment in this country was historically robust, because they understood we had a strong rule of law system that protected that. It's why people believed that they could get justice from the justice system, because there is accountability even for the rich and powerful. Not pretending that that system functioned perfectly, it was deeply flawed, but the whole point was that we always aspired, right? In an era of racial inequity, there were people who came along and said, we need to reform the justice system so that it's fair to Black people, doesn't just treat white people or wealthy people preferentially. And so we can appreciate the system and work to strengthen it while recognizing its flaws, but understanding that the rule of law is really the foundation on which democracy is built. You can't have a democracy without a strong rule of law that establishes people's rights and responsibilities and that carries out the vision of the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. We don't get there in a linear or a perfect fashion. You know, the country is founded with the disgrace of slavery, a stain on its founding. And yet look at what we accomplish. We continue to transform, move forward, expand the promise of America to groups of people, to waves of immigrants, to the LGBTQ community with marriage equality. That has really been the trajectory of a rule of law country. And it is perhaps why the rule of law has been so under attack these last few years.
How do we know when we've succeeded in protecting democracy? You know, you wrote in the book, quote, we are in this fight for democracy for the long haul. It won't be a straight line forward, so we better get ready to face it with grace, style, humor, and one another. So how do we know when we've succeeded?
I'm not sure that we ever succeed, right? I mean, I think that it's a fight that we fight in every generation. There will always be people who will be opponents of democracy because they will, you know, they will want resources, they will want money, they will want property for themselves. There will always be opportunists who will try to benefit at the expense of the rest of us. And that's the beauty of a democracy. It gives us the tools to continue to fight that fight. And our fight is different, right? Our grandparents fought on battlefields in Normandy. We'll fight in voting booths. I don't know what the next fight will look like. Maybe it will be in cyberspace. We have the tools that we need. We just need to understand the moment and care enough and understand the consequences if we cease to live under democratic rule.
So what's one thing listeners can do to support that fight for democracy?
You know, this, I think, is the most important question, right? What do I do? So many people feel like they don't have the ability or the power to do anything. And so I would encourage you to do whatever you can. It's going to look different for each of us. One of my neighbors, we had this conversation like 6 years ago. And at the end of it, she went out and volunteered to work in polling places. And she ended up becoming the deputy commissioner in our polling place, got really into voting infrastructure and helping people understand why it worked and how they could have confidence in it. That's great if you've got the time and the interest in doing that. For some people, it might look like writing postcards to voters in purple states, reminding them to go out in advance of elections. There's a lot of an organized effort to do that. It's incredibly powerful. There's data that suggests it really helps with voter turnout. For my money, you know, one of the most basic things that we can do is pay attention to our local races, because so often people go to vote and they have no idea who the folks in the local races are. So I think it's great to educate yourselves and have conversations with the people around you. You can even, you know, these candidates, they're going to want to come to your home and have a little coffee clatch and meet your neighbors. That's grassroots democracy at its finest. But you can get involved in all sorts of initiatives. Big concerns headed into this election about whether we will have to have identification, maybe even a passport, in order to be able to vote. There are a lot of groups that are working on those issues. You can literally go online. I sort of lay out a bunch of suggestions in my book, which I think is now widely available in public libraries. And so that's maybe a resource that you can take a look at if you want ideas about what will work for you.
Joyce Vance is the author of Giving Up is Unforgivable, a manual for keeping our democracy. Joyce, thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much for having me. I love the name of your podcast. It's the most perfect name for this moment.
Thank you again.
It can be exhausting, Josh, to keep up with what's happening in today's world. I recently came upon a cartoon with a couple walking down the street, and she's saying to her friend, "My desire to be well-informed is currently at odds with my desire to remain sane." Mm-hmm. And yet, given what's at stake, as Vance very clearly described, we kind of have to find a balance, don't we?
Yeah, and the studies of mental health effects of politics right now are really stark and really interesting. And that said, the tendency to just want to turn inward is what is going to perpetuate the problems, right? So if we decide to throw up our hands, if we decide to just focus on our everyday busy lives and say that politics is not for us or democracy is going to be fine without our participation, well, we're going to be that frog in the pot that Joyce mentioned. So although it can be distressing, we need to do little things to keep ourselves sane. You know, maybe that means not doom scrolling on social media, but getting out and talking to neighbors, going to community organizations. That can be good for mental health and good for democracy.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas is our writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm the series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond and Landon Palmer, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, and Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.